We are now going to talk to Monty Shaw, Executive Director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. With the recent threats to the renewable fuel standard coming out of Washington, Monty's interview will likely be of interest to people with all opinions about ethanol and biodiesel. Let's start with what he has to say about ethanol plants.
Well, we're a state-level independent trade association. It's a voluntary group, so if you produce ethanol or biodiesel or some other renewable fuel in the state of Iowa, you could choose to join and sit on our board and tell us what to do. And in short, that mission statement is to take on whatever activities we can to promote the production and use of renewable fuels. So we'll do things, market development, consumer education, regulatory work, lobbying work sometimes, and things of that nature.
Do you have all of the ethanol plants in your association?
No, not every ethanol plant in Iowa is a member.
So how many ethanol plants total are there?
We do it by members, so we have 18 members right now. That would include 15 ethanol members and 3 biodiesel members. Some of those members have multiple plants. You know, we're up in the mid to upper 20s in terms of the plants we represent, and there's 43 ethanol plants in the state of Iowa currently.
So the Stover plant over in Nevada is also with you.
It was sold off to a renewable natural gas producer, so we no longer list it as an ethanol plant in the state of Iowa.
Well, to get back to the ethanol plants, I was particularly interested in the locations of those plants, because my impression was those are mostly in small towns, and in many cases they're a major industry for the town.
That's true. And on our website, which is iowarfa.org, under ethanol.
So what is the total production of those plants?
So in Iowa, we produced a little over 4.3 billion gallons last year. They could produce more, but, you know, it's dependent upon the market. So we did produce a record amount in 2018 of ethanol, and that was 4.35 billion gallons. We also produced a record amount of biodiesel at 365 million gallons.
Well, I know that with ethanol, it's at every pump. So there's no problem unless you have the E15. Do you lobby for that or you work on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, right now, I mean, because E10 is, you know, as you mentioned, more or less ubiquitous and is by far and away the largest user, you know, 90% in Iowa, something like 95% nationwide of fuel is going to be E10. There's not a lot of growth opportunities there for our industry. So we do spend quite a bit of time promoting near-term options like E15 can be used in all 2001 and newer cars, which is basically almost all of them now. And it's over 95% of the fuel goes in those cars now. And we also are doing things on the regulatory side and whatnot to try to, you know, be working toward even higher blends in the future.
Yes, I've heard about E85.
Yeah, so E85 is available now. It's about one in every 10 Iowa gas stations offers E85. Unfortunately, due to some changes in the incentives for the automakers under the Obama administration, we're seeing a fairly dramatic drop in the production of the flexible fuel vehicles, FFVs for short, that are required to use E85. It's kind of a sad story because, you know, we've really had an expansion of E85 availability over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's corresponded with a reduction in production of the cars that can use it. So we are working hard to try to convince the current administration to reverse that and to put in a small incentive, say in the CAFE standards or something like it used to be, for automakers to continue to produce flexible fuel vehicles.
Well, of course, environmental fuels implies that this has a significant environmental benefits. What are those?
Yeah, so there's a number of positive benefits from the use of ethanol, and so you mentioned, you know, there's price, there's energy security, there's the impact on rural economies and jobs, and you mentioned the environment. I kind of break it into two different boxes on the environment side, but however you want to look at it, doesn't really matter. So one is the reduction in tailpipe emissions. So as you add ethanol, you're doing one of two things, and it kind of depends on how it's blended. You're either directly replacing petroleum-based octane components with ethanol to get the octane you need to, you know, for the car to run. And if you're doing that, you're quite dramatically reducing the use of some wonderful chemicals, I say that tongue-in-cheek, called benzene, toluene, and xylene. Benzene's a known human carcinogen. And the combustion of those chemicals in our engines leads to the exhaust of ultrafine particulate emissions, which are really, really bad. And in fact, I would say only in the last 4 or 5 years has serious study been done on these things, and at least preliminarily, the impact looks horrific on people who are exposed to exhaust fumes. So particularly urban folks and say, let's say Harvard's done some studies where it looked at some of the poorer neighborhoods that are clustered around the, you know, like very close to the interstates, you know, or big roads, the children living there are particularly harmed. And so that's something that we reduce. So whether it's carbon monoxide, whether it's particulate matter, and other things like that. Now, even when you go from E10 to E15, and you're more or less just adding another 5% ethanol on top, you might say, you're still diluting, right? So you got the actual displacement of some of those products with ethanol as you went to E10. And then as you go up the food chain, you just continue that displacement or dilution, however you want to look at it. So it absolutely has a beneficial impact on, you know, what you're breathing because of how it cleans up the tailpipe emissions. Now, the other big environmental issue that's in the news these days is obviously climate change and carbon emissions and things like that. And the biofuels are significantly reduce the carbon footprint of the fuels in your car. And so for folks that are looking to do things to kind of decarbonize the transportation sector, ethanol and biodiesel are by far and away the most impactful things you can do in the near term. And so we think there's a big role to play there as more and more states domestically and more countries internationally are putting a carbon metric in their fuel requirement.
Is all of your ethanol, is that by definition corn ethanol?
No, it's not. But to be straightforward, the vast majority of it is. The ethanol molecule is the same once it's produced regardless of the biomass feedstock. So any biomass we could turn into ethanol. The world's cheapest source of ethanol is from corn starch. We also have a number of plants, and we wish the number was higher, but the EPA has not, for the last year, has been stuck in neutral in approving new approvals for these plants to do this. But we have the capability now, through different enzyme technologies and different things, to produce ethanol not just from the corn starch in the kernel, but from the fiber that's in the kernel as well. And if we can convert that fiber, or at least a portion of that fiber, a significant portion of that fiber in the corn kernel, we can produce more ethanol for the same bushel of corn, and the resulting distiller's feed that comes out of that, our feed co-product, the starch is gone. That's good because cows, chickens don't need any more starch in their diet than I do. You know what I mean? That's not what we're short of. We're short of protein. Well, if we can take some of the fiber out of there as well, that really makes the distiller's grains a very high protein feed as well, you know, kind of rivaling soybean meal. It's a good feed no matter what, it's just another way of, you know, kind of adding value to the feed because it's a more concentrated protein on one hand, plus you're getting more ethanol by converting the fiber as well. So that's primarily what we're seeing in Iowa. There is Project Liberty up near Emmitsburg, which is producing some cellulosic ethanol from corn stover, you know, the corn residues.
Yes.
That was also what DuPont had planned in Nevada, but when they went through their restructuring, that project kind of got shuffled out of the deck, and so that's been sold off. But in other parts of the world, you have ethanol that's made from sugarcane, cassava. Even here in the United States, not in Iowa, but in Kansas and other places where it's a little drier, they'll make it out of grain sorghum. So there is a diversity.
Yes, and now I have discovered the quote from Art Cullen that I thought would be a counterbalance to this discussion. It's his historic view of what happened with ethanol. And I think I'll start with the post-World War II ag boom had ended. Smelling a bargain as farm assets imploded, Wall Street started to invest in pork in the late 1980s, the same way it had invested in concentrated integrated poultry production. It discovered that you could make pretty decent money using cheap corn and cheap help in a building built by the farmer with his own debt to raise hogs on contract for the meat packer. At the same time, the farms that had been selling were moving into stronger hands. It was a triple whammy. The cattle left Iowa because the land was too valuable. Hogs moved indoors and out of open markets, and the stronger landowner could use chemicals to manage ever larger acreages inventories. Ethanol, made from distilling corn, was reaching commercial scale after a strong decade of experimentation spawned by the oil crisis of the 1970s. Farmers long besieged by corn price swings saw energy demand as a way to stabilize corn markets and so a new base outside traditional livestock feeding. Ethanol and the corn sweetener industry developed simultaneously based on the zeal of Midwestern corn farmers who came to see it as their salvation from just making do feeding corn to hogs, cows, and chickens. Ethanol came to be politically sacrosanct as it grew to consume a third of Iowa's corn crop. In 2017, more than 4 billion gallons were hooched from 43 distilleries in the state. It was a bipartisan purchase of the rural vote by Democrats and Republicans. The golden cap came with the energy legislation in 2007 that established the renewable fuel standard, requiring 15 billion gallons of ethanol to be blended with gasoline nationally to reduce smog in big cities. These developments bankrupted farmers, Wall Street investing in livestock for the first time and moving them off the landscape and betting on the corn ethanol game, ushered in the specialization of agriculture in the late 1980s and squeezed out on-farm diversity and unneeded people. It suited the big ag players. The seed and chemical companies could deal with fewer customers who were bigger and could be locked into their supply chain. The corporate players didn't need the retail feed stores or the local general veterinarian in the county seat towns anymore. The pork integrators had their own feed mills and vets on retainer. The result was a steady drain on rural life. The impression was indelible in physical and psychic terms. Had the sun set on the place we cherished. And I guess that's what the Mighty Earth people are talking about. But ethanol is only part of the issue here. And Monty also spoke to us about his version of the corn that goes into ethanol. I have a question about the scale of the industry. One, but how many acres do you think it takes to produce the amount of ethanol that you have, the corn ethanol you have? And the other one would be what proportion of the corn crop is used for ethanol?
Yeah, nationwide it's about a third, but I want to stress something here, and it's because that's to make ethanol, the industrial corn oil that we sell, and all of the high-protein distillers' feed products that we sell. It's not just ethanol. The only thing those ethanol plants are converting into ethanol is the corn starch out of that kernel of corn. And for a handful, we hope more in the future, but for a handful, they are able to convert some of that fiber if they got their approval before EPA stopped giving approvals under EPA Administrator Pruitt, who's gone now, and we're hoping that those will start up again. 100% of the protein goes back out into the animal feed market where the corn would otherwise go. So I just want to stress that. In Iowa, because we have a higher concentration of ethanol plants, we'll use, you know, and of course it depends on the demand of ethanol in any given year that rises and falls and depends on how much corn we produce, which, you know, Mother Nature makes sure, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 55% of Iowa corn will go into an ethanol plant. Again, not just to make ethanol, but to make ethanol and the feed co-products. About 1.5 billion bushels of corn are going to be processed in Iowa into ethanol and those feed products.
And there's another biofuel we haven't talked about yet that is not connected to the renewable fuel standard. It's biodiesel. And it's a lot more beneficial as a fuel than ethanol is. I'd like to read from the IRFA, that's the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association website. Biofuel is a greenhouse gas reducing advanced biofuel that is a great alternative for diesel users. Biodiesel is not only sustainable, it's more environmentally friendly, cleaner burning option that can be used in diesel engines without modification. In fact, biodiesel decreases greenhouse gas emissions by 56% to 86%, meaning that the use of biodiesel has already cut 75.5 million metric tons of carbon pollution. That's like planting 1.9 billion trees. Biodiesel is also non-toxic and biodegradable. Using biodiesel lowers particulate matter by 47%, reduces hydrocarbon emissions by up to 67%, and reduces smog. Its environmental benefits don't stop there. The production of biodiesel in lieu of petroleum diesel reduces wastewater by 79% and hazardous waste by 96%. Biodiesel does all this while also providing the highest energy balance of any U.S. fuel, a 5.5 to 1 positive energy balance. This means that for every unit of energy input, biodiesel returns an astounding 5.5 units of energy. So let's hear what Monty Shaw has to say about biodiesel. Do you have many biodiesel plants?
Yeah, I mean it's you know, it's similar but different. I mean biodiesel is its own it's a very different process, comes from different feedstocks, and if you know, at the simplest terms, ethanol is typically blended with gasoline, and biodiesel, as one might suspect, is typically blended with diesel. So we do have a number of plants in Iowa. We have 11 operating plants that can produce, they produced over 365 million gallons last year, which was a nice step up. They could probably produce, not quite, but closer to 400 million gallons if the market demanded it. They use a diversity of feedstocks. Here in Iowa, we primarily use soybean oil. We have a lot of soybean production, a lot of soybean crush facilities here in Iowa, so we'll use the soybean oil. We also use a lot of corn oil. The ethanol plants can actually separate the corn oil from the distiller's feed product at the back end of the plant, if you will, and sell it separately to feed markets and to biodiesel producers. And so corn oil has become a growing market. We also have different types of animal fats and greases, as well as we haven't done any canola oil here recently, but there's parts of the country and the world where they use a lot of canola oil. In other parts of the country, sometimes it's called rapeseed oil. And then one of the growing markets, particularly in larger metropolitan areas, is the used cooking grease or the used cooking oil. And so that's an exciting development where you used to have laws being enforced that tried to prevent restaurants from dumping the stuff down the sewer drain because that's not a good environmental practice. Now those same cities have passed laws making it a crime to steal it because now it's valuable because people will pay for it to convert it into biodiesel. So,
are all of these plants owned commercially, or can people just find a way to burn the local grease that comes out of their...
Well, there are people who do that. I'm not going to tell people not to do it. I'm just going to tell you that to ensure that your car runs properly and for a long period of time, you have to have on-spec fuel that meets all the required specifications. And those are very tight specs, very high quality. You know, when you're in one of, you know, my members that's producing it at an industrial level, a commercial scale, they are meeting extremely, extremely high quality specifications. And they have the labs, you know, they'll have literally $1 million or more of lab equipment on site where they're continuously testing to make that happen. You know, when some guy's making some biodiesel in his garage, and there are people who've tried that and stuff, and if they want to put it in their own car, that's fine. Most of them no longer sell it commercially because they simply cannot consistently meet the specifications. But, you know, it can be a teaching tool, though. So Iowa State University, they have a biodiesel program that's run by the students there where they do collect the used cooking grease, and because they have access to the, you know, university facilities, they are able to convert that to biodiesel at a very high quality, and then it's used in some of the, I think, SciRide.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been exploring biofuels through an interview with Monty Shaw, Executive Director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. He was just telling us that a student club at ISU was making biodiesel for SciRide buses by recycling cooking oil from college dormitories. I had to call SciRide to confirm that, and they referred me to Rich Lehners, who agreed to a phone call to answer our questions. Hi, Rich, are you with us?
I am.
I'm so glad. Thank you. Now, what do you do at the DOT that you are involved with biodiesel?
Okay, so I work for SciRide, and I oversee the maintenance for the fleet and the facilities here at SciRide, so the maintenance on the buses.
So you know whether the engines are in good condition?
Correct. Diesel engines.
Okay. They're in good condition from the use of the recycled fuel from the dorms?
Correct. Iowa State has a student-run organization that has a biodiesel lab, and they take the grease and oils from the dining centers and turn them into biodiesel for us. And it, like I said, it's a student-run organization, so the quantities aren't real large, but we take whatever fuel they can give us, and we put them right in our fuel tanks here at SciRide, and then in turn use those on the road here in Ames.
Is this a fairly regular, are they a reliable source?
Well, for the most part, yes. It's a student-run organization, so the quantity that's produced varies with student availability. So, some semesters they deliver a set quantity every week or two, and other semesters we may not see anything for a month or 2 months.
By the way, I talked to Mary Rankin, and she told me the name of this organization is ISU Biobus.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who might be aware of the organization. So what do you do when you don't get the locally produced biodiesel?
Well, we're always using biodiesel, except that we're bringing it in on by the truckload with our normal fuel delivery. So we always have a minimum 5% biodiesel being used here at SciRide, and at times we'll go up to 15% and even 20%. We do cap our use at 20% because that's all the engine manufacturers will allow us to use and still honor the warranty on the engine.
But it's really true that you can use the just regular the grease right into your engines as long as it's purified.
Correct, as long as it goes through the quality standards that Monty talked about to make sure that that it meets the preset standards for the buses.
Some of the buses say on the side that they are hybrids.
Correct. That would be our SciRide buses. And those came back in 2010 and 2011. They were part of the stimulus money at that time. And we purchased 12 of those. And those actually use a standard diesel engine. And the analogy I always like to use is they're like a Prius or a hybrid car. And except in the case of our buses, it's a standard diesel engine coupled with a high-voltage capacitor supplying the electric energy to drive the bus.
And what kind of gas mileage improvement is there?
Our cybrids get about 7, up to about 12 to even 13% improved fuel economy, which may not seem like much, but when we're running these buses day in and day out, it actually turns out to be a substantial savings over the course of a year.
So is there anything else that is might be of interest to our listeners about your about CyRite?
Well, a lot of the funding for alternative, what the federal government calls alternative fuels, they actually provide incentives for us to buy alternative fuel vehicles. And the next generation coming will be electric buses. And we've actually just 2 weeks ago had an electric bus in Ames and doing a demo and having a look at it. So that's on the not too distant horizon.
Well, then we'll have to get to work on the coal-fired plant, right?
Well, perhaps, or another way, it may even perhaps wind energy to power the bus.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so very much. That was Rich Lenners, and thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Bye-bye.